Good morning. My name is David Whitney. I've been with Microsoft for close on 20 years now, and most of that time spent with Exchange. I'll be talking this morning about sort of the high-level stuff about how Outlook talks to Exchange Server. Due to various scheduling requirements, I should have been going last after other people gave you more of an overview of the lower-level stuff, but I'm going first. So I'll be covering the basic structure of how a MAPI application is written and how that translates into the wire protocol underneath when talking to Exchange Server specifically. The wire protocol was designed in tandem with the programming specification for MAPI pretty much at the same time. So the parallels are very, very tight. Right, so here we have a basic layout of how everything is structured. We have an application like Outlook. It could be another application that's written to use MAPI as an abstract API. MAPI provides the system in place to allow an application to use generic storage providers, generic address book providers, and transport providers without really needing to know the details of each. Are they located locally on the machine? Are they RPC to a foreign machine or whatever? And what particular wire protocols they might use to talk to foreign machines? And then those providers are written on top of the Windows operating system, which is going to provide stuff like memory management and using RPC for over-the-wire communication, or maybe the HTTP stack if you'd be going against, say, a Hotmail server. Right, so when the MAPI application starts up, it will log in to MAPI as a subsystem and then start getting these pointer references to objects, which are very COM-like, but not exactly COM, for the different classes of things that the MAPI application is going to have to deal with. You've got your logon session, you've got message stores. Within the message stores, you've got folders and messages and attachments, recipients on the messages, and so on like that. And each of these objects provide methods for getting properties, setting properties, opening streams, opening up sub-objects, things like that. Right? So the application makes these method calls, and then they translate into whatever they're going to translate into through their provider off to their back end. Right? So this is the basic flow of how a MAPI application works. So application starts up, it initializes MAPI, it will open up one of several available message stores, and then within that message store, it'll open up the root folder, get a hierarchy table under that folder to find subfolders, or open a contents table of that folder to find messages. Then it might open up a particular message, read properties from it to be able to display them in an open note, or if it has just the contents table, it could do the summary view, the sent and received times and the subject and things like that. And we can see here the parallels between the API one might call and then what the exchange provider will pack up into the ROP buffer and send over the wire to the server. Right, so now in your MAPI application, each open object is represented by a pointer to an object. It has a virtual table with methods and so on. The open object identified against the server in the MAPI provider is done through an integer, which is called the server object handle. So whenever you're going to make reference to a particular object, you have to pass the server object handle for the object that you had previously opened in the ROP buffer, along with the various parameters that you're going to pass. Right? So what will happen is you might call a method on a message object that says get properties. The provider will pack up in a buffer the server object handle for the message, the operation you want to perform, get properties, and then the parameters that you're going to be passing on. So you have the prop tag list that you want to get. These get packed into the buffer, and then they get sent off to the server by calling ecdo-rpc. It's not always the case that a particular method needs to be executed immediately. Some of these things can be deferred for efficiency reasons. For example, you might already have an open table, and you want to set the view columns on it, you want to set the sort order, you might want to set a restriction on it. All these operations do not need to be carried out immediately. And we have designed into the mapping provider for Exchange the ability to defer these operations. They get packed into the buffer. It's not an emergency. We don't have to do it now. So it just sits there and waits. And so these operations pile up, and eventually a method needs to be called, a ROP needs to be issued, where the client really needs the results now. So eventually, you know, you'll call query rows on a table. The client wants rows. So all the ROPs get sent up to the server at once, and then it processes them all one at a time. So the idea here is to avoid the number of round trips that the client has to make with the server. So we can pack these things up, make only one RPC of the server, instead of having an RPC for every single method call that the client might make on the abstract objects. Microphone? I can take some now. Is that on? How do you turn it on?
It's true that you do one call, one RPC call, but do you have a sense of like making multiple RPC calls at the application level at the same time? Do you have concurrency at the level?
I believe the Exchange provider prohibits that. I'm not entirely sure. You can get into some serious threading problems if two different threads try to issue an RPC against the same object at the same time. We have locking on the server side to prevent multiple operations on the same mailbox at the same time. But I think the client could get itself seriously confused. I don't know the...
No, about different objects from the same...
Right, okay. So you could have the situation where, for example, Outlook could have multiple threads going on where they'll have some operations batching up for disparate objects going into the same ROP buffer. That is a possibility. Say, pass the mic over.
It can happen to have a sync of your inbox, for example, while a send email goes in place?
I suppose so, yeah. Right. So you could, for example, you could pack into a single ROP buffer. Going with the example we have here, I'm sorry, I keep pointing at the screen. The client could have two tables open and being processed by different threads for whatever reason. And so thread one could say, I want to set columns on this table and query rows. And thread two could say, I want to set columns and then query rows. So the two set columns for the two tables would get packed into the buffer, one right after the other. And then the two query rows. One of the query rows would force the RPC, so it would go up. Then the other query rows would come in on a separate RPC and go up because the buffer is now empty and this one is forced. So yeah, you could have interleaved packing in one buffer.
Do you have like a limit on, based on a Windows version, number of threads that you may do in parallel? Because that may translate into number of RPC connections down at Windows.
I do not know the answer to that. Other questions? No? So here's a brief summary of the parallels between a method call that the application might make and then what will be packed into the ROP buffer. So the application says, on the folder object, I'm going to call get contents table, and the default parameter is 0, and then the output is going to be this new table. What gets packed in here is we pack in the ROP get contents table, the logon ID for the session this is relevant to, the folder server object handle for the folder that we're using, and then what comes back out to be determined is the table server object handle, because the server is going to open a new table, assign a new handle, and return that to us, and then the parameter 0 that we specified right here. So then that will get put into the ROP buffer, won't necessarily go up to the server right away. Then we do a set columns, so we pack in the set columns, the logon ID again for the session that we're using, the table server object handle. Now this is where it gets interesting, and the lower level people will go into greater detail about making references to objects that we haven't opened yet. That is more of a detail of how the ROP buffer packing works, and I'm not an expert on that. But yes, you can make future reference to objects you don't have references to yet. But you'd pack that in here, and then the count of property tags that come in that array, and then the actual list of tags. That gets packed into the buffer. Next, client calls query rows. So again, the logon ID of the relevant session, the table server object handle, which we don't have yet because it hasn't even been sent up to the server to be opened yet, and then the other various parameters. So the 0 and the 10, I don't remember what the 1 is for. All this gets packed into the buffer. The client's called query rows. This one has to be forced. Off to the server it goes. That's pretty much all I had to talk about. We can spend the rest of the time answering questions. And somebody needs a mic up here.
So again, about the parallelism of things, maybe you can share some more information about from Exchange side, what is the coherency model and like what is locked when you specify that you don't allow multiple operation? What's the data of integrity? Is it an logon or it's based on a handle? You know, what? How does that? What's the this? How does the model works? What are the behaviors?
So the concurrency is handled on the Exchange side that whenever a operation begins processing for a particular mailbox, we lock access to the mailbox for the duration of the processing of that operation.
It's
per logon
index, that's what it is?
The logons, so each logon is going to be to a specific mailbox. You might have multiple logons to the same mailbox for whatever reason, okay. And the client might have logons to other mailboxes, and there might be other clients that have logons to the mailbox in question. So whenever a particular operation comes in for, you know, logon A, which is referencing mailbox A, we lock mailbox A.
Okay.
We hold a critical section for the duration of the processing of that ROP. Nobody can do anything on mailbox A until this ROP is done processing.
Okay, thank you.
Right, but the lock is released. We might have multiple operations to process on that same mailbox in this one RPC packet. And we lock and release and lock and release and lock and release for each operation.
Public folders,
the locking model is different. I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but generally speaking, the lock is held only on the relevant folder. And then when hierarchy operations are done, I believe we lock the hierarchy. I don't remember the details of that. So if you're going to add or remove a folder, we have to lock the hierarchy. But then whenever you're playing with content of a folder, we do not lock the entire public folder structure. It's just the one folder. And then also only on the one replica that the client is communicating with. If a folder has multiple content replicas, there's no intra-server communication to lock the folder on other replicas. Microphone?
Do you actually have a list of ROPs that can be packed? I can do captures of Outlook and Exchange and guess by myself that for the query roles at some point,
right.
I can pack the get contents table, the set columns, the query roles. But is there a more extensive list that we can rely on and say, okay, if I want to reproduce the exact same behavior than Outlook and also do the packing, I can refer to this document or whatever.
I don't have that information. I don't know where that information might be recorded.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that the decisions are made by the Outlook team. The Outlook team owns the Exchange provider that used to be owned by the Exchange team, but now the Outlook team owns it. So they're the ones that make the architecture decisions on which RPCs need to be forced and which ones can be deferred. I don't know that. Any other questions, or is this going to be the shortest talk of the day? Here we have one.
Does the Exchange have the concept of what did you say? Okay, let's say EC2 connect creates a session context, right? So do you apply locks at the session context level, or can you explain how Exchange maintains the session context?
The session context is essentially your RPC handle when you've made the connection. You don't have any logons yet at that point. So there's nothing to lock, I believe, at that point.
What's the life cycle of the session context? I mean, do you keep...
Until you call disconnect or the RPC connection is dropped because the client crashes or something.
Okay. You don't really associate that with the TCP connections or association groups at the Exchange level? And do you maintain like a session context table on a per association group?
No. We have a request to repeat that question.
My question is, how are the session contexts organized within Exchange? Is it categorized per association group? That's between a client, per client session, client TCP session.
A lot of it is handled by Windows directly. I mean, the client makes RPC calls to the server. It'll initiate the RPC connection. And then by the time it gets to the back end in store, we just know that we've got a new context handle that's been created by the operating system. And then we keep the list of known open connections, right? And so as they come and go, as the client expressly drops them, or we get a connection handle rundown from the operating system saying the client's vanished and we need to dispose of it now.
So you do have some sort of awareness with respect to client association and session context. For example, if client dropped all the connections, you would drop all the session context associated with that.
Yes.
We have
to do that because the connection handles they have to be validated. We have to be sure that any RPC that is using a connection handle is using a valid connection handle. So we have to be able to look that up and say it's still in our list of known connection handles. So, for example, if we do get a rundown from the operating system that says we have to drop this connection handle now, but then the client didn't understand that the connection has been dropped, so it tries to make another call on that existing connection handle, either the operating system or the Exchange backend has to validate that handle and say, no, that's dead. You can't use it anymore.
I see. So if the client drops the connections and reopens the connection, you don't share the session context, that means?
No. Each ECDO connect creates a new session handle and a new session.
Okay.
Question over here, Mike?
So the session context created by ECDO connect can be shared by multiple RPC session, correct? RPC connection, okay. So the relation between the Outlook clients to number of RPC session to number of TCP connection, is there anywhere spelled out how it is done?
I believe that's all maintained by the operating system. I don't know too much about that.
It's basically, we observe it's a many-to-many, and we see that part of the problem.
Because what I've seen that with 2003, there are a lot more connection session than 2007.
Uh-huh.
So something definitely dictated by Outlook?
Yes. Outlook makes the decision to make extra connections. Why? I don't know.
One more question about the OPNUM 0 that used to be ECDO Connect.
Yes.
Original. It's been reused by ECDO Async Wait with version 13, I believe. Is there any reason that why it is reused, not used 15 or 16 or 17?
Which one now?
So the OPNUM 0 used to be ECDO Connect.
ECDO Connect, yeah.
Connect. Now ECDO Connect EX that OPNUM 10 operation number. Now with the version 13, now you use 14 comes ECDO Async Connect, that number 14. But instead of 15, that ECDO Async Wait is reused the OPNUM 0. Basically, ECDO Connect is replaced by ECDO Async Wait.
I have
and
no
that's kind
idea.
Of
it's a different interface.
Correct. Basically, you have to go ahead and look into the version number which the Outlook client is.
Into the bind and now the context index to know which interface it is. So
yeah, I didn't understand why not use the next number in there.
It's a different RPC interface. They made it a different RPC interface.
Yeah.
Also, the next session, just for you know, that the next session talks about the MSMDB interface, session lifetime, session versioning, EC2 connect extended, async MSMDB interface, EC2 async wait extended. So,
yeah, my subject matter is more on going over the very high level stuff, the parallels between how an application uses MAPI and how the exchange provider talks to exchange server.
Does the exchange provider ever drop sessions? And does it initiate dropping of sessions, or is it always client initiated?
Yeah, when the client logs out. So when
but
when
it's client initiated, but.
When Exchange will just drop the connection?
Or drop the sessions.
So Exchange server does not... Okay. Generally speaking, the operating system will tell Exchange server when a connection has been lost for whatever reason. The TCP timeout has elapsed, whatever. Exchange server will force off sessions that are related to, for example, a database that's about to be dismounted. So if the administrator wants to dismount a database, all sessions that have logons to mailboxes on that database, the sessions are entirely invalidated because the amount of interrelated state among the various mailboxes, even if there is, you know, if this session has 17 mailboxes open, one of them's on this database you're trying to dismount, the session's punted. All 18 logons are dropped. The client's left in a lurch. It'll have to re-log on to those other mailboxes that it still can log on to because those databases are still mounted.
Is that the only scenario where the exchange would drop
the session? No. Exchange will force a client out when the mailbox is being moved. In older versions of Exchange, when the move initiation started, we would drop the user forcibly. And the move mailbox technology has changed now, where we are able to move the vast majority of the mailbox with the user still connected, and then right at the very last minute, we force them to log out by dropping their session, and then the last little bits of changes that may have happened get moved, and then they're forced to log in on the new copy.
Just when you change on the secret
cast. Yes.
So there's no timeout. It doesn't enforce any timeouts for sessions.
I don't believe there's any kind of a timeout, no.
So those are the two scenarios, move and the database dismount of the session.
Any other kind of emergency situation that might be coming up. There's no admin configurable setting to say force people out after 6 hours. I don't believe there's anything like that.
And can you cover a little bit on the exchange admission control, like for new clients or, for example, when exchange is really busy, what does it do to back off clients, for example, async write drop back offs?
That will be in another talk, I believe.
Thanks.
Anything else? Am I done? Okay.